Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to this. I guess we're going to have to call it Eggonomics. It is the podcast about rugby and business. I'm JB, and this episode is brought to you by Beardmore & Co. Independent Financial Advisors. Now, I know that you know who that is, but let's face it, if I don't say that, I don't get the morning off to do this podcast. So, we are regulated and authorised by the FCA, and you know the rest. Of course, it would be remiss of me to do any kind of rugby content without pointing out we have our main podcast, Egg Chasers, which of course you all know about, and the YouTube channel, which Tim has developed wonderfully. If you enjoy all this content, you'll definitely love that content. Okay, let's join Mark Evans. Now, last week, I had a bit of criticism that I didn't introduce Mark particularly well. So, to give you some background, Mark is the business guru in rugby that I turn to when I need something answering. Formerly of Harlequins, formerly of Saracens, formerly of the NRL, and currently playing his trade over in Fiji with the Drua. Mark, how are you?
Well, we're all right, although we lost to Moana Pacifica at the weekend, which was to say it was disappointing is to understate the case.
I saw that.
Yeah, disappointing. Yeah, they were much better. We weren't very good. We weren't very good until the last 20 minutes, and they were much improved. Tana O'Mara's done a really good job with them.
What is the thought there? Because obviously you're similar teams to the outside world. Are you kind of rooting for their success, or does it just make it a bit more of a bitter rivalry? How's that dynamic?
No. The Pacific Islands just all get along terrifically. Okay. The players get along terrifically well. They are seen as they're always fierce games, but they're very. It really is sort of shake hands, let's go for a beer, sort of, or a bowl or something. You know, it really is.
Oh, good. Well, I say good. I was kind of hoping that you'd say it is a fierce rivalry and they all hate each other, but not quite.
No.
Well,
all hate, you know.
Talking of fierce rivalries, there was something which came up this week, and I've got to get your opinion of it. It came from the chairman of Coventry Rugby Club, and then it was later confirmed by Wasps. So the chairman of Coventry Rugby Club thinks Wasps would be better in the URC, and then Wasps later on confirmed that they were exploring the option of the URC. Now, I'll give you my initial take. I think it's a terrible idea, but I imagine you've got a more nuanced take. So, sorry to load that on you without any preparation, but what's your initial thought around that?
Well, right out of the blue, that one.
Right
JB.
Out of the blue. It only happened yesterday, I think.
Did it? And Coventry floated it, did they? I think they'd be better out of Coventry than how about the URC.
Yes.
Is that the context?
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Well, I think I don't quite understand that, if I'm honest. Because what are you doing? You're saying, let me just think this one through. You're saying that a quintessentially English rugby brand can somehow work or be part of a league that almost defines itself as not being English or French, actually. You know, it's the sort of rest of Europe and South Africa's league, isn't it? No. My gut feel is no, and anyway, where the hell would you play? Which I think we're going to talk about soon, aren't we, Stadia? Which
exactly.
Is critical. I mean, a lot of these sort of slightly, you know, horrible, hackneyed and very, very dated phrase of, you know, blue sky thinking. it was a trace of nimbulus. It's just nonsense, really, because you just got to think through the... You just have to think for, you know, a couple of minutes about, well, how'd you fund it? Or where'd you play? And what's the stadium?
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking. So, like, if you had your hands on Wasps now, Mark, yeah, and it is a quintessentially English brand, what would you do with it? Because for me, finding a stadium... I mean, you're going to end up in somewhere like Oxford, aren't you, with no real history to Wasps, unless they get lucky in London somewhere. And then you're going to end up just pulling in players left, right and centre, kind of like, well, London Welsh, I guess, would be the example. There's not any real Wasps feel to it. I think they're better off at the lowest level of the pyramid and starting to build again. And if it takes a decade, it takes a decade.
Yeah, I don't see... I didn't agree with putting people at the bottom of the pyramid way back in the day. I thought that was nonsensical as well. Okay, so two things, you know, just because I don't think Wasps should look for salvation outside of England doesn't mean I think they should go to the bottom of the pit. But I don't think that Richmond should have done either, and I don't think that London Welsh should have done. I think it's a terrible, terrible precedent.
I'm not sure. And I'm not sure that I agree with that, you know.
I'm sure you don't. I'm sure you don't, because you're a free marketeer in tooth and claw, aren't you? And, you know...
I think it's more fundamental than that.
You're going to say, don't reward failure. I think the French system's miles better, okay?
Okay.
The French system is miles better. Well, apart from the fact I wouldn't have promotion and relegation in the first place anyway, but if you happen to be stupid enough to have it, right?
Yeah.
Puts you on the back foot from a business point of view right from the get-go.
Completely agree.
I mean, I thought, by the way, big story of the week really is NRL in Las Vegas. Not Las Vegas. But let's not divert quite too early in the pod. When clubs get into financial ruin, as they do in France, and they have done for many, many years, and they have a couple of very sensible things. They have an independent financial regulator called the DCNG. I think I might have got the initials slightly wrong. I'd have to look them up. But anyway, they've been around for years. You have to put all your financial information into them. And if you don't make good on your promises for the year and you don't balance your books or fund your losses, they relegate you for financial reasons. But they don't relegate you to the end of the world.
Yeah.
They relegate you one or two leagues, which, yeah, to my mind, says you messed up. You probably lied to us, but we're not really going to spend and waste everyone's time working out whether you were lied or just incompetent. You screwed up. You're going down two leagues, which is what has happened over the years to some really big clubs. It happened to Bourgoin, who were the big team near Lyon until Lyon revived about 10, 15 years ago. Bourgoin,
God, I forgot about that.
Chabal and his mates, they were the big team in a tiny little village out just outside of Lyon.
Yeah.
But they served that sort of the rugby community of that part of France. I seem to remember Narbonne, you know, very storied club.
Mm.
They got into Béziers, I think. Yeah, lots of clubs have got into
There is a difference.
It's managed, just like everything else.
But it is different, isn't it, to say, look, there's some financial impropriety here. Maybe it's breaching the salary cap like Saracens did and getting relegated a league.
Yeah.
And then being completely insolvent, which is what happened to Wasps. I think there is a distinct difference there.
Isn't that only a matter of degree?
Yeah, well, I think it probably is, but I think it still matters. You know, if you can no longer fulfil all...
Why your obsession with the binary?
Because if you can't fulfil your fixtures and you've fired all of your staff, there's no core of a club there, is there? Whereas if you look at Saracens, they managed to go down with a core of their club and bring it back. So, go on.
They only went down with the core of their club. Worcester would have gone down with... You know, let's say you'd relegated Worcester. What would they have had and got rid of the... The crew that had put them in that place in the first, but let's not, you know,
yeah,
that wasn't actually so much that was much more bordering on the asset stripping criminal than it was on the incompetence.
Yes.
But, you know, let's say, and the great problem there was lack of oversight. You know, the fact that there's no fit and proper person test, nobody at Premier Rugby or the RFU appearing to want to know anything about it until it was too late. I mean, that's the problem there. Let's at least focus on the real problem, which was a complete lack of governance and oversight that allowed that situation where a club with huge amounts of assets, with a great narrative, you know, legacy of Cecil Duckworth, you know, to basically go into administration. I blame the lack of oversight and controls.
I don't disagree with that.
To say there was nothing left, but was there nothing left at Wasp? Of course there was. Well, there was the fan base for a start.
Well, okay, so that's a good question. What was left? You could pick up the Wasps brand, I think, for 30K.
The fan base was still there. Let's use Worcester as a better example. The fan base was still there. The stadium was still there. The assets were still there. Put them down to Division 3 and say, sort yourself out.
So I'm not
Why do you have to get that vicarious thrill of driving them down to level 12 and a half or whatever it is? So I don't get it.
I think there's a few things going on there. So I think that if the rules state that you go down to level 3, that will be the rules, and I'm quite happy to do that.
Okay, yeah, this is your stronger argument. Yeah, go on. It's a crap rule, but it is the rule.
Yeah, basically that. So, you know, when Coventry say we don't want somebody who's basically a franchise coming back into the Championship, I'm fully on board with them, because everybody needs clarity as to what the rules are and what the future is. That's fine. Now, the more pragmatic view that I think I have on this is, you said you didn't like Richmond or London Welsh and how they were treated.
I didn't like the way we put Richmond, London Welsh and Wood, and people are arguing for Wasps and Worcester, if they ever come back, and London Irish, presumably, to go to level whatever it is. I think it's just destroying value. I just don't get it.
Well, I kind of disagree with that, because I've followed London Welsh relatively closely since they went down. And I really like the story of them coming back. And I think as they are climbing the leagues, you build your new heroes, you build your new fan base. You know, it is an amazing opportunity for somebody in Worcester or someone in Coventry to get access to help their club, who would never in a million years be able to access the professional team. So, you know, I really like Sale Sharks, but the chances of me being able to show up to a Sale Sharks training session and hold a bag and contribute to them getting into the European Cup is negligible. But once these teams go down, they can build up again, because otherwise you're just left with a soulless team. In Wasps' case particular, they would have to move probably. I mean, they might not. They might do. But it's not the same
this
club.
Obsession with, hold on, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah,
this obsession with moving, right? Well, in that case, Arsenal would never have left South London, would they? They'd still be in Woolwich.
I've not bothered about moving per se. But
you just did. You said they have to move in a slightly derogatory manner. You did.
Well,
you did.
Yes, but they're not. You know, we're not talking about within London. We're talking from Coventry back to London again. I have no problem with that. If, again, it's a, you know, franchise model and the brand of Wasps is intrinsic to the league. Like, you would never kick out the New York Giants, you know, because they're intrinsic to the league. But those, again, aren't the rules.
No, I do accept your strongest argument, Art, is these are the rules and other clubs have had to suffer from them. And therefore, because those were the rules that were in place at the time, that the same should happen to these two, three clubs. I do understand that on the basis of consistency, and you knew the rules before you started.
Yeah.
But that's like you'd never saying you'd never change a bad law.
Oh, I'd definitely change the laws. You know,
I think that was my argument. I said I didn't like it when it happened to clubs 20 years ago. I think the rules should have been changed. I would accept that if it hasn't been, to try and alter the rules after the event probably makes a bad situation even worse. But it should never have got to that. And anyway, the real problem was not that Wasp's business model, which actually wasn't a bad business model. They were actually quite unlucky.
I do agree with that.
That model they were trying to build there was not a bad model. And without COVID, maybe, they certainly were going to go bust at Wickham. But there's absolutely no question about that.
You know, I do agree. There's a huge difference between Wasps and Worcester, which is why I didn't really want to talk about Worcester, because I agree with your assessment on that. And I do think that Wasps were fundamentally unlucky. Yeah, I mean, they took some gambles. There's no two ways about that. But I'm all for taking gambles if that's what you want to do, as long as you know the consequences.
Stem from what we're going to talk about in a minute, I think, which Wasps' peripatetic nature, if you want to call that. Yeah. I remember, you know, when we used to play Wasps, you used to go to North West London near Wembley Stadium and play them at Sudbury. All of Wasps' travails through Sudbury to QPR, Loftus Road to Wickham to Coventry to wherever next, if anywhere, Kent, whatever, or the URC, which seems the most strange one. Anyway. Yeah.
God, we've not spoken about Wasps in the URC yet.
It all came down to a search for a stadium.
Yeah,
that's what it was all about.
Well, just let's go back to stadiums a minute, because I just want to put forward, you know, a bit more about London Welsh. So,
right.
when they faced the trouble that they faced, particularly in the Premiership, they had to relocate to Oxford. I mean, a team called London Welsh has no business being in Oxford. I think that's the first thing. And then when they went back, and particularly after they went bankrupt and were relegated to whatever they were relegated to. In fact, I'm not even sure they were relegated. I think what actually happened is the pro club folded and the amateurs took over everything. So I don't actually think that they were relegated per se. I just think the pro club ceased existing. But do you not think they're in a much better place building slowly in that community now, being who they are in Old Deer Park, than they were in the Kassam Stadium with a bunch of players that have no history or no understanding of the club, which is effectively what they did for 2 years? Surely that's a better solution for them.
I have to declare an interest here.
Okay. Far away.
I have to declare an interest. I was consulting into London Welsh when they were in the second tier.
Yes.
And I was asked to present to their board as to what they should do going forward. And at the time, they were the very best semi-pro club in England. Very best. They were a time when there were two or three full. When I say semi-pro, I mean they weren't full-time. The players were not full-time. They did not train 5, 6, 7 days a week. They had other jobs, most of them. And my recommendation to the board was that they should stay exactly where they were. They'd done a fantastic job. The club was thriving. It was a great mini section, a great amateur section. The pro section, semi-pro section, had reached the top of the tree, and they were in a stadium stroke ground that couldn't possibly be developed. So you couldn't play Premiership rugby there. And anyway, they didn't have anything like the infrastructure or the finances to be able to do it successfully. That was my recommendation. And they listened very politely to the board and some very eminent men on that board. And they said, thank you, Mark. Thank you very much. But if we did want to go to the Premiership, where do you think we should go? To which I had a little sort of, guys, you know, but all right, you know, you're a consultant. You've been asked for your opinion. So I gave my opinion, which was there are only three markets left in England. Anywhere in the south, I'm assuming you don't want to go north of the Trent, which have got a market big enough to, in theory, support a reasonably viable Premiership team. Now, this is around about 2010, 2011. 2011, 2012, I seem to remember. I said, one is Cambridge, but there isn't a stadium there. And now they are talking now in February when they're fourth in the league.
Yeah.
Right? They're at Cambridge. There isn't a stadium that would meet the criteria in Cambridge. So that it's got a market, maybe. It's the smallest of the three, but maybe. the middle of Kent, which is deeply ironic, of course. If somewhere around Sevenoaks was my second one, it's got a definitely market size that could support with a lot of rugby around. But again, no stadium, so that's not a solution for next year. So by process of elimination, the only city that it was very crowded in the Thames Valley, because London Irish was still in Reading and Wasps was still in Wickham. Mm-hmm. I said Oxford, because at least it's got a stadium that you can rent. And I thought that was the end of it. It was almost like a thought experiment. And anyway,
little did you know.
Bugger me, they got into the playoffs, they won it, which was a big surprise. People forget that. Yeah. Nobody expected to win that playoff.
Did they beat Bristol?
And I can't remember now. Was it Bristol? Was it Cornish Pirates?
Cornish Pirates. Exeter?
I don't know. I don't know. Can't remember. It wasn't Exeter. Exeter won the Premiership by then. Anyway, they beat whoever they beat. I'm sure the listeners will tell us. And bugger me, they went off to Oxford. And it was the least worst option. There's no doubt about it. And I think it's a little harsh to say that they didn't take any of their own players with them, because they did. And I helped them out trying to get a crowd. We got 10,000 for one game against over Christmas, New Year. But, over Christmas, New Year, still it was a decent effort.
Yeah.
But the point being is, if you haven't got a stadium, A, you don't meet the criteria, but even if the criteria wasn't as some people would say it's too strict, but it's almost there to protect people from themselves. And London, Welsh should be a great example. Yes. But they went to court, and it was whatever it was, a restraint of trade or something. I don't know, I can't remember that. But they won it. They had a very, very clever man who was on their board. Who was
that Geraint someone?
No, it was.
Is his wife?
Bledin, his name was.
That's it, Bledin. And his wife is the ambassador to Russia.
Something like that. Yeah, very lovely man, clever man, passionate about London Welsh. And I had an owner at the time who was putting money in. But, it's the old, you've got a very, very deep pocket. So if you haven't got a stadium, and we come back to Wasps, and London Welsh and Richmond, if you haven't got a stadium, even with all the other issues that there are in the game that need fixing financially from a business point of view, but that is the number one. If you haven't got a stadium, look at the history of the sport in the last 30 years. The search for a stadium, case studies, Saracens?
Yep.
With probably probably one of the most talented property guys in the UK, Nick Leslow, on their board, right from the beginning, great bloke. Really, really good bloke. And it took them the best part of 20 years.
It's incredible,
isn't it? Find somewhere in London.
Oh, we just need
to. With the amount of capital they could access.
Yeah. Well, you need to talk to Sale Sharks about their struggle with a stadium.
They were going to be my other one. Or Sale Sharks. Or Newcastle Falcons and the sale of Gosford, or look, there's any number of them, because the stadia, yes, professional sport to some degree, or in certain sports, is a broadcast product. But every broadcast product, before it becomes such, is an audience product. In fact, they're just two sides of the other. The audience, whether it's live, or the audience, whether it's on broadcast, all sports rely on the size of their audience. That's basically how the business either works or doesn't work. And if you haven't got chicken and egg, have you not got a fan base because you haven't got a stadium, or haven't you got a stadium because you haven't got a fan base?
Yeah. Well,
and
let's come back to stadiums, because that is interesting, and we're going to talk about that in a bit more depth. But just relatively quickly, or as long as you want, I don't mind. If you were in charge of Wasps right this second, what would be your preferable route to, I'm not going to say, and I hate this word because I don't mean it in the way that everyone else means it, sustainable rugby. What would be your route? URC, Championship, bottom of the National Leagues?
No.
What is it?
I honestly think unless they are fortunate enough to find yet another extremely wealthy person prepared to subsidize it.
Yep.
For a lengthy period of time with little or no hope of return, mm-hmm. I wouldn't bother.
Well, this is it, isn't it? This is the problem.
I think I'd try and build up. I think I'd go back to the amateur club at Acton, I think it is. And
hang on,
which still exists.
Isn't this my plan? Wasn't this my plan at the very start of the podcast? Go back to your roots and build from there.
Just because you're right every now and again, maybe, doesn't mean you shouldn't get a bit of it. No, I do think that this I understand from a Wasp ex-player fan point of view that, you know, the story, they've won the European Cup, they've won premierships. It's incredibly hard to accept that those days are probably gone forever.
Yeah.
But they probably are. I think there's very little hope, if I'm honest. And that sounds really hard, doesn't it? But I think you asked my opinion.
Yeah.
A bit like the London Welsh board, feel free to ignore it.
I think I'm completely with you. I'd go back to Acton and I'd go from there.
The bit about your thing I don't buy is the idea that you can suddenly rise again like the Phoenix
and go
back to where you were. That's not practical.
You will find your level. So I think like the London Welsh level is a phenomenal rugby club that is well supported, made up of city folk who are not fully professional, but they get a bit of extra on the side. And the reason you play for them is because some old boy who works in your stockbroking firm, and that's an old, or your bank or your trading desk played there before. That to me is the perfect model for London Welsh to service that market. I mean, you've got to tailor your offering.
It is about the only city. It's in fact West London is about the only part of the only city that can sort of support that model.
Yeah. And if that's what they do, they should just concentrate on doing that to the best of their ability and not be ashamed.
Well, Richmond have taken that one stage further, haven't they? And said, and we're not going to pay.
Yeah. And Richmond run four teams. I mean, that is a success in of itself. It's not a success in terms of European Cups, but I don't think that's a bad thing. Sale FC, I mean, slightly different story, but they went all the way down to the bottom of the pyramid. They've slowly risen to National 2. That's where they belong. They're a sort of a feeder club to Sale Sharks. They give excellent rugby to good amateurs and semi-professionals. That's a perfect model for that club, and it's sustainable. And I think that's what... I'm not saying you rise back to Heineken Cup. I'm saying you rise to a level that is... you know, is good for your club. And, you know, you're not going to be Leicester Tigers because they're very good at being Leicester Tigers. You've got to be your own thing and offer the product to your community. I hate that word. But, you know, whatever your niche is.
In some ways, it's a non-monetary, a largely non-monetary operation.
Yes.
I mean, it's a self-help society playing sport. That's what it is.
Yes, it is in a way. It is.
Brilliant. And none the worse for that. I mean, we all come from clubs like that. Mine's in the middle, you know, in a Cardiff, St. Peter's. That's my club.
Yeah,
that's where I'm from. And they would never dream of going professional, and nor should they. It would be an absolute. There would be absolutely no chance of it. It would be ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the important point. I mean, just I don't think that any club has the right to be professional, and they should go and find their own level. I don't even think... I mean, if the rules state that, okay, you're a professional club and we've ring-fenced all the professional teams and you live in this ecosystem of Premiership and, say, National Leagues, well, those are the rules. But as it is currently constituted, I see no problem with them going down and finding exactly what it is that that club should be. And it might not be in the Premiership. It might be National 2. Might be Championship.
I think we'll disagree on that bit. Anyway, let's move on.
So, just going back to what you were saying before, stadium criteria. So, a lot of clubs who are trying to get a shot at the big time will always bemoan the fact that, oh, well, we can't build a stadium, but what does it matter? Because Sale Sharks only get, you know, less than 6,000 on some nights. So, I'll start with this. How important do you think the stadiums are, and how hard is it to actually get one? And also, I wanted to expand on your other point, which I really enjoyed, which was maybe it's to save these smaller clubs from their own ambition.
Yeah. Well, it depends what you're trying to be, is the answer, I think. As a sport.
Yeah.
Okay? As a sport, not as an individual club. It's what you want to try. Do you want to try and have a full-time, and I do use that rather than professional, a full-time league in a country or group of countries? And if you do, then most sports in most countries, not all, I accept, but most, have looked around and decided that actually the best way to do that without losing the least amount of money is to put some kind of criteria around, which does two things. There's one set of criteria called equalization policies, which try and stop the emergence of dominant clubs. Yeah, salary caps, yeah. Salary collars, et cetera, et cetera. There's lots. CBAs, there's lots, right? And they are executed independently by an independent league or commission. And that's there to stop the big getting bigger. It's a bit like sort of the Monopolies Commission, only in sport. And on the other side, there is the criteria to stop one very rich person putting all their money into the team and saying, I've won the second division, you've got to let me up, but I play on a park. Don't care. My team's as good as your team. I deserve to be up. And quite understandably, and particularly when the league starts to get to generate some central revenues, the clubs who are already there, so hold on a minute, we've gone through years and years of losses here. We built up value. We've invested. Now you want, and we've invested in our academies, and we've invested in our grounds, and we've taken out huge loans to build new stands and build up capacity, because television doesn't want to come and show a game from your field, by the way, right? Because it looks terrible, and that's not the type of product they're after. You running around in front of 500 people on a grass field in the middle of nowhere is not really what we're after.
You know, that's a really powerful point, isn't it? Which I don't think I've mentioned before on Egg Chasers or anywhere else. But just paying for a bunch of good players on a field is a pretty nifty way to get hold of central revenue.
Think about it logically, JB. If you I've heard you many times, and Phil too, because you know I'm a Patreon member, and I pay you. It grieves me that I pay you good money, not much, but a bit nonetheless. That follow the incentive. You're always saying that.
Yeah.
Right. The incentive drives the behaviour. If you've created a league of value for a group, and that has now generated over time, it's taken a long time to get there, this generated some significant broadcast revenues and some significant attendances and some significant sponsors, and people have lost money for years and years building that up. And then somebody comes along, there are no barriers to entry, they can play on a park, and he comes along and says, I'm going to spend £6 million on my team, and that's all I'm going to spend. I don't give a toss about building the crowd up. I don't want to build my own players. I'm just going to go out into the market and put a really good squad together, and we're going to play on that little park down there, and you can't stop us because there's no barriers to entry, and we're good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do agree with that.
Nonsensical, isn't it?
But what do you say to the clubs that say, okay, look, we've only got 5,000 capacity, but what's the average Premiership attendance? I mean, it's more than that. But when you see the attendance to Newcastle, so, what do you say to them?
So, well, for a start, you say, some clubs, and Sale and Newcastle are the two that people always point to, and they happen to be working in the most difficult markets in the country. It's a damn sight easier to run Harlequins well and successfully, or Northampton or Exeter, than it is to run Sale or Newcastle Falcons.
Yes.
So you have a choice here, and I'm you know, I think there's arguments for both. You either say, like the French do, and like the Australians do in a number of their sports, we don't give a toss about being a national sport, right? Why bother, right? Rugby league, incredibly strong sport in Australia in the NRL, having that wonderful weekend this weekend, you know, in Las Vegas, opening two games. What a great, it's taken years and years to get there. They only operate in two states and Melbourne, two states and the Storm. That's basically it, right? So they're operating in a market of about 12 million people, okay? Do they try and get into South Australia? No. Do they try and get into Western Australia? No. Do they try and get, why not? Well, because another sport's got it. It's too hard. The market's too small. They don't, but they've tried, and they got rid of it after a year or so. The West Coast Reds, they were called, or something like that. Mm. Anyway, Adelaide Rams, I seem to remember. We, on the other hand, have decided, and I don't know whether it was by luck or judgment or by default, that we want a national footprint. We are a national union, you know, Yorkshire traditionally. You know, well, actually, before the split with Rugby League, the North was the strongest rugby union area of the country. And you can stem, you could argue a lot of rugby union's problems in England, not elsewhere, come from the 1895, but different argument, different podcast.
Yes.
Fascinating. But if you want a national footprint, and there are arguments for that as well, particularly broadcasting, for example, there are arguments against it. So you say you want to be strong in your areas of strength and never mind the areas of weakness. So there are arguments both ways. But if you're going to go for a national footprint, you have to either accept that for quite a long time, the clubs in the weaker regions are going to be weaker and need to be subsidized.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yep. Otherwise, they'll just be bottom of the pile forever.
Yeah.
Because it's harder. They won't drive as much revenue. Right? So AFL, for instance, when they're trying to get into Sydney, which they've done reasonably successfully, it's taken them 40 years.
Crikey.
They give the second club in Sydney, who they're called the Greater Western Giants, they get more money than anyone else.
Really?
Why is that? Yeah. And so do the Gold Coast Suns up in Queensland, which is a rugby league state.
Yeah.
Right? They get more money. Why? Well, for obvious, because it's so much more difficult. If you're going to say to Sale in Newcastle, look, you get the same distribution as everybody else. We know you haven't got this. We know you've got a more difficult market. We know you're not such a big brand. You're right next to Manchester United, Liverpool, Everton, Man City, and Newcastle. You're a bonkers football city. But we don't care. Just get treated like everybody else. They will fail.
Yeah. Well, the thing with Sale, I mean, so, people don't talk about this. Actually, Sale's crowd numbers were rising faster than the rest of the league. They were the number one in the league for crowd growth, and then COVID hit. I think it is possible in the Northwest because of the population, and it's something different. A lot of people do not like football. A lot of people do like football, but a lot of people do not like football.
It may be possible, but the point I'm making is it's more difficult.
Yeah,
the reason why you have things like, you know, why do you stop? This is the sort of protect them from themselves argument, right? Because if you're not careful, you can get such a good team Getting the team's the easy bit. Getting the business is the difficult bit.
Yeah.
But you put a team in somewhere like, I'm going to upset people now, Ampt Hill.
Right? Okay.
Now, I'm assuming that no one at Ampt Hill ever really seriously wants to go to the Premiership. Right?
Yeah.
Well, I hope not, anyway, because they should never be allowed. If time ever came where if Ampt Hill come top, they can just waltz straight in, we might as well pack up and go up.
Would you be more sympathetic? Would you be more sympathetic to Ampt Hill or anyone if they did it the other way around then? So what if they started with a massive stadium? Like the first thing they did was built a 10,000-seat stadium.
There are clubs like that. And the one that always springs to mind is Darlington.
I was about to mention Darlington. Yeah. Darlington Modern Park play there now.
You could have two things. And actually, this is one of these. It's not enough. A stadium is necessary but not sufficient. Okay?
Mm.
Not having a stadium, yeah, that's a real problem. Having a tiny bit of grass and a couple of rickety old stands aren't up to standard for anything that purports to be a serious professional sport is not acceptable.
Yeah.
But similarly, on its own, it ain't enough because you need a market. You need support. You need a fan base.
But what about...
You need to be popular enough because otherwise you rattle around. It's what we used to call the... I'm going to insult a load of people this week, aren't I? The London Irish problem, right? Which was they went to Reading from... Sunbury into a stadium that was lovely, but too big for them, except on St. Patrick's Day. Well, we all know what happens in stadiums like that, don't we? Eventually, people hate it and they start to agitate for a move, and that happens. Stadiums on their own give you a shot.
I tell you a better example of that, Edinburgh. Edinburgh playing in Murrayfield was a farce.
Correct. And here's an example of a club that did it really well, Glasgow.
Yep.
I never ever thought that they would get a half viable team up and running in a football mad city. Yeah. I thought they were Liverpool and Newcastle writ large. And I was wrong. Yeah. They've done it. And part of the reason they've done it is because the stadium they chose was able to be built out in phases, and it wasn't too big. They could sort of grow into it.
Okay. So what about then? I mean, the model I think about stadium-driven success would be Racing. So Racing were languishing in the French third level, so not Pro de Deux, but one below that. And, you know, you think about the other things you can do in Paris, the other teams that are in Paris. I think Racing now are probably the premier club team, or one of, purely based on the fact they've got this amazing facility. Like, you go to you go watch Racing because you want to go to the stadium.
To a degree, Lord Copper. Isn't that the phrase?
Yes.
I mean, Racing, don't forget, and you're a young buck, clearly, but Racing in the 90s did also have, even though they had no kind of pre-professional, they had no kind of ground or anything, but they had a hell of a brand. Yes. Frank Minnell and the boys drinking champagne at halftime and in the grand final, in the Bouclier final. You know, the whole wearing pink bow ties, which then morphed into Eden Park and that brand, right? I mean, it's to say that Racing had, you know, were like almost like a Parks team is just not true. And also they have a hell of a heritage. And it was just that rugby in Paris, until really quite recently, was moribund. But Stade Francais, who I think were level six, and Racing, who I think you're right, were level three or four, were little more than sort of part-time. Well, the whole game was part-time, but they were not a force, and they hadn't been for decades and decades. But, I mean, the Racing Stadium thing is a really interesting one because, and this is when we come down to the differences, because we talked a lot about English rugby and whatever, but the context of stadiums is very political. Yes. And on the whole, we come from a country where governments – very, very rarely spend money on stadia. With the exception of Wembley and the Olympic Stadium, I can't think of anywhere else significant. Yeah.
Which, by the way, is completely correct. Is completely correct. As they shouldn't. However, they should allow people to build stadiums.
Well, all right, that's a view. Let's go to the other end and go to a country where the government builds stadiums all the time. Well,
America.
I was there this weekend. Well, you can see the state. Yes, the States and Australia. And you have got there a completely different model whereby building stadia for privately owned, in some cases, sports clubs is seen as a very, very sensible thing for local and central governments to do because of the economic benefits that it generates.
Yes.
So, I'm just about to put a bid in next week to the Fijian government to build some floodlights so we can create a big event in the next couple of years. Okay?
Yeah.
I can't do that without government funding, but I'm making the argument that the return on their investment will be a serious multiple.
Well, when I used to do a Brexit podcast with the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce, they were talking about the economic benefit of football to Manchester, and it's enormous.
Yeah.
It is enormous. But there again,
it's enormous.
They've also done it. Well, I'm going to say done it with private money. Do you count Arab money as private money, or do you count it as something else? I don't know. But certainly, Manchester United was the stadium there was built with private money, and looks like it will be built again with private money.
And that's fine, JB. But what about if you're an Olympic sport, which isn't professional? What about stadiums for them?
Yeah, well, there's been a long and storied history of Olympic stadia being used once and now an absolute disaster.
That's why West Ham got the deal of the century when they got the London Stadium for a song. I'm literally a song because there was, and the problem there was, it needed to be wherever it was for the Olympics, huge. And there's only one sport in this country that can ever then inhabit it on a regular basis and fill it, and that's football. For example, why have you ever thought, I'm going to make an argument here, which I think I can defend, doesn't mean it's necessarily true, but I can certainly make an argument.
I believe it.
I can't prove it. 93% of boys in this country go to state schools. At which they almost certainly play basketball, because virtually everybody goes to a state school, plays basketball, because in the winter, it's a great way to keep 20 boys occupied for a lesson.
Yes. That's
fantastic. You play in the gym. Brilliant. Everyone plays basketball. Has it ever struck you why we've never had a successful professional basketball league in this country, unlike many, many European countries?
It hasn't, actually. No, I've never thought of it.
Well, given what we're talking about, have a think about it. What do you think it might be? Everybody plays it. We all know the game. We've all played. But if you went to a state school and you're a boy, and actually increasingly girls, because it's got part netball in some schools.
Why not?
We all play it. We understand the rules. We like it. There's loads of kids play it. There's grassroots coming out your ears. Why have we never, ever successfully created a professional basketball league?
I just don't find it interesting. But because I don't find the sport interesting myself. I've never considered this question. I guess, is it political backing?
Well, let me ask you a question. Where are they going to play?
Yeah.
Think about what you need for professional basketball. You need skyboxes. You need fantastic sound system. You need a brilliant technotron in the middle of the court.
Yeah.
You need about 10 to 15,000 seats.
Yeah.
And you need a big space and car parking. Right. Tell me. Not including music venues, because they're not set up the same way. You can't play basketball in a music venue with a massive conversion, right?
Yeah.
Give me a stadium that's got a basketball or netball or indoor sports arena of any size in this country. You'll come up with a handful.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Why is that?
Don't know. Why is that?
Governments don't build stadiums in the UK.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of have no problem with that. But, yeah, it's an interesting point, because I think if that many people are playing at a grassroots, there would eventually be somebody interested enough to build one of these things. But it's not one person, is it?
Yeah, well,
it's a handful of them. Well, I'll give you a better one, yeah. Which I was blown away by, and it makes me want to build this facility if I had the money. But I was watching Trafford Netball play the other week, and they are phenomenal. I mean, they're really good. They are Premiership 3. And I was like, yeah. I can't believe I am watching what is effectively like the equivalent of Championship rugby. Maybe it's National 1 rugby. But actually, these are two good teams. So, yeah, probably about Championship rugby.
Strongest netball region in the country, the Northwest.
Yeah, they don't even have their own clubhouse. I was amazed by this. I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean going to a school? I assumed they'd have their own netball hall somewhere. Nope, nothing.
And that, a lot of people would argue, rightly or wrongly, whether it's a good or a bad thing, and I think you and I would probably disagree, is that we live in a country where it is not. There's never been the political will to build stadia. There's been political will to build leisure centres,
yep,
and things like that, which is more of a health thing than a. And you could argue that that is a better use of public money, and I wouldn't necessarily argue against that. But have you ever thought, for example, why have we got so many fewer? We've got a lot more now. It used to be awful. We used to have virtually no 50-metre swimming pools.
Really?
And, yeah, hardly any.
Well,
hardly any.
No.
So what I'm saying is stadiums and arenas are highly political. You know, in some countries, Australia, New Zealand, America, United States, there are huge amounts of public and private money going into stadia across a whole range of sports. Not before we even mention universities and the spend there.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? So, in certain countries.
this is a path that I bet you never thought the podcast would go down. But I was reading the other day, just to sort of highlight the differences between what we build compared to what everyone else builds.
We are at one end.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of a town called Norlistic? I think I'm saying it right. And I think it's Norilsk.
No.
So this place is one of the most populous places in the Arctic Circle, and it's described as the worst, most depressing city in the world. It's in Russia. It's a mining city. And every year its population decreases by 2 or 3. I think a few years ago it had a population increase by, say, 50 for some unknown reason. It is a hellhole. I started reading about this place to find out what was there. And actually, as I read down Wikipedia and got to leisure and entertainment, they have got better sports facilities than most British cities. And I was astonished. They've got an Olympic weightlifting gym. They've got volleyball courts, basketball courts. When you said 50-metre swimming pool, I was like, well, they have one of them too. I just couldn't believe it. And this is just the norm. Yeah. This is the norm in Russian cities. Now, I'm not saying I want to live there, but it is an interesting contrast.
It's a lot of stadium stuff is, you know, we started talking from a rugby point of view, and you know, maybe we'll revert, but a lot of it is the political context that you operate within. And then we also have this other peculiarly English thing. We don't seem to like shared stadia.
No.
Now, again, lots of countries that think that is weird.
Well,
okay.
It is coming back to haunt them, isn't it? Like Juventus would be a classic example, who had a shared stadium with a running track. Like, no, this is terrible. Mm. I think the Olympic Stadium in Rome is terrible. I think most Romans think that too. So I'm on the fence with that. I see why it'd be beneficial, but I also see why it's not.
Yeah, but you've immediately jumped to the conclusion.
Go on.
Right? Which a lot of Brits do, which is that a shared stadium has to have an athletics track around it.
Okay.
Right? Well, that's just not true.
Yeah.
Right? So, again, declare an interest. So, I worked at Amy Park, which is in Melbourne, for 3 years, as I think you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 4 teams played out of Amy. Okay?
Wow.
One, Melbourne Rebels.
Yep.
Rugby Union. Melbourne Storm, Rugby League. And Melbourne Victory. And what was then called Melbourne Heart is now called Melbourne City. It's one of, and Melbourne Victory is where, when I was there, was, what's his name? Andrew Nakulu was the manager. He's now managing Tottenham.
Yeah.
And Melbourne City at now was Melbourne Heart. So 2 football and 2 different codes of rugby all played at the same stadium on the same pitch.
Yeah. Well, I guess.
Okay. Absolutely no problem at all. We had our own changing rooms. They had theirs. We had our offices. They had theirs.
That sounds like a great working environment, actually.
It was a great working environment. It was in the middle of the sports precinct. It was absolutely wonderful.
Did you build any relationships with the other?
Just over the road.
Yeah.
One of the iconic, mind you, in between there and where we were and that where the MCG was, cricket and Aussie Rules, shared stadia. 5 Aussie Rules teams played out of there. 5.
Wow. Just back to the Amy Stadium. Was there any sign of collaboration between the teams that shared the stadium, other than match day and stuff like that?
What way?
Just commercial ideas, sporting ideas.
I used to chat about sport all the time. I mean, it was a great place to work because most of the sports venues in Melbourne are all in this one precinct. So you had the 4 what they called rectangular sports. That was us, right?
We
were the 4 relations.
Yeah.
So we were having to slum it in this 257 million, 28,000-seat stadium. It was terrible. Then MCG with 100,000 was over the road. But between them and us was the Rod Laver Arena and the 2 other courts for the Australian Open. And then next, the other way, it was Collingwood's training ground, which was massive. And the other way, it was Richmond Tigers' training ground, which was massive. So you had this incredible sort of sports complex where you exchanged ideas and what have you. And, you know, and people looking for a career in sport, high performance, you had to like flit about between the different teams all in the one venue. My point, though, is about stadia, which is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
The idea there that you wouldn't share a stadium would have been seen as absolute economic madness. And you say, well, what about why? How did you get 5 teams in the MCG? Well, the answer is they all used to have their suburban grounds. They all used to have their own grounds, right?
Yeah.
So Collingwood, they're all named after suburbs of Melbourne. So Richmond played in Richmond, Collingwood played in Collingwood, et cetera, et cetera. But it was economic suicide. So they centralised it. They've got 2 grounds and 9 teams, and they play there in the middle of the city with great transport links and easy to get into, easy to get out of.
I think the issue might lie in the fact that a lot of our sports club owners, they don't want to be part of the ground. They want to own the ground. They want to be the guys taking the rent off everyone else, I'd imagine.
Yeah, well, the difference is, of course, all those days tend to be, again, we come back to the politics. They weren't built, well, the MCG was to a degree, but the rectangle, the Amy Park was built with government money. And over the road, there was a great basketball netball centre, which was built with public money. And guess what? You know, 2 professional netball teams and 2 professional basketball teams shared it.
Yeah.
Now, my point is this. We have a situation where, for whatever reason, it's historic, it's cultural, it's whatever, we don't feel very comfortable about it. Look at the fuss that West Ham fans made about the Olympic Stadium. It was too far away from the pitch.
I think my fuss would be
I get that.
Yeah.
I do get it.
I think my fuss would be more fundamental.
But they did get the deal of the century. I mean, they're a bit ungrateful.
Yeah. Well, my fuss would be a little bit more fundamental than that. Like, I could not stomach Manchester building a sports complex with government money whilst there's potholes in the road or that there's traffic. Like, to me, that would blow my mind that they would do that.
But don't forget, what you started this with was the economic benefit that football brings to Manchester.
This is true.
Why should that be entirely in the private sector when it could be in the public sector and then redistributed?
Well, I've got many thoughts on that. However, on the multi sports grounds, I do think this is a great time to bring it back to rugby, because one of the things which has come up in the news recently is that the NFL teams were horrified with the provisions at Twickenham, and Twickenham might need $600 million spent on it to bring it up to standard, and that blows my mind.
What blows your mind about that?
Just the cost of it. I mean, I understand that's Twickenham right. might not actually
I thought
be
it was going to be that the NFL were horrified by Twickenham. That doesn't blow your mind.
I've not really thought of it. I've always thought of Twickenham as a pretty good stadium. So, in a way, that's been a bit of a shock to me to hear another sport come over and think, this is awful. we can't deal with this. And maybe, well, I don't know, maybe I need to...
Don't forget that's partly because Tottenham have built a stadium just for NFL.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole point of the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which is undoubtedly the best stadium in sports stadium in the UK as we speak.
Agreed.
You know, they actually built it in, didn't they? You know, they it slides in and out, and it was designed with the NFL coming over every year in mind. It cost £1 billion. Okay? It's the most expensive sports stadium, I think, in the UK's history.
Yeah.
And it's no surprise that they've built NFL locker rooms for them. I mean, it puts Twickenham into the shade. Of course, they'd rather go and play at Tottenham rather than play at Twickenham. It's built for. I think this is the point I was making. Unlike most English stadia, it was built for two sports.
Yes, it's a good, very, very persuasive point. That
because it made business sense. Because those NFL games have started to become, well, not started to become, they were always at Wembley, weren't they,
yeah.
Remember? But Wembley effectively is a football ground, and there are certain compromises you have to make to play NFL at Wembley. Although I went to a first game there, and they did seem to think it was great, and they're iconic, and all the rest of it. But Tottenham is more purpose-built for it.
Well,
got to be able to fill that 30 times a year.
So, okay.
And the only sport that can do that at the moment in this country is football.
So, a really interesting story was this position the RFU find itself in out of paying £600 million, which they obviously can't afford, or maybe they can, but it doesn't sound like they can, or getting rid of Twickenham altogether and buying half of Wembley. Just bearing in mind what you've said about all the multi-sport stadiums and the success, I think it's very persuasive, actually. Would you be up for the home of English rugby uprooting and going to Wembley?
Would I be for it? Can I say I'm Welsh? I don't really care.
Yes, you absolutely. Well, that's always my defence.
No, that would be a lie. Well, not that I'm Welsh, but that I do care. I do care. I spent most of my rugby career, so of course I care. I'm not sure. Without seeing the numbers, I think it's really tricky.
Do you think it's mostly? Do you think it's exclusively or mostly a numbers issue?
Well, look. Let me start from the big stadiums. Whether you're building them or refurbishing them, are very, very lumpy businesses. They require huge amounts of capital at very, very intermittent stages. So you build it and for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, it's absolutely fine. And then eventually at some point it turns into a white elephant.
Yes.
Look what happened to Wembley. Built in 1923 for the Empire Games, absolutely iconic stadium for its time. But 90 years later or whatever it was awful.
Yeah.
That, I'm afraid, is what happens to stadia if they're not refurbished and maintained and all the rest of it. And I don't think Twickenham is a terrible stadium, but I do think it in places now, given it's been pretty much completely rebuilt in the last 40 years,
yeah,
in phases, but it is a bit tired.
It's very
and
similar.
And it won't be cheap.
It's very similar.
It won't be cheap.
In Prince...
Old Trafford, you're going to say, aren't you?
No, I wasn't. I was going to say it's very similar to something which I know a bit about because it's my family background, but owning bars, restaurants and hotels. Like you spend a fortune on these things and then 5 years later you need to spend another fortune. And if you think that your first spend is enough and you're going to spend that frivolously, you're screwed. As soon as you build that thing, you need its revenues to buy the next thing.
Yeah.
It's always the same.
They're not easy businesses. I mean, that's why lots of stadiums build in phases. So they're trying to spread the capital spend out over a longer period. But if you're actually faced with a major refurb or a rebuild, even, and then you've got the question of what do you do while you're rebuilding it? where do you play? Which was Tottenham's problem, if you recall. So what did they do? Well, they went and played at Wembley.
Oh, yes, they did, didn't they?
They went and played at Wembley because you can't stop playing because the red, well, you can't stop playing because the competition doesn't stop because you've got to build a new ground.
Yeah.
But you can't drop your revenue too much either, even though you're now paying rent because you're not in your own stadium and you probably don't get all the F&B revenue and all the way that, you know, stadium economics work. But but White Hart Lane, much though we loved it, he says as a Tottenham fan, you know, it was way past its sell-by date. And the new stadium is absolutely wonderful. But we're it cost £1 billion or more.
Yeah, it's...
And that's difficult to finance.
So what have we discovered today, Mark? The stadium can't be too big. It can't be too small. It should hopefully hold at least four different sports from two different teams and maybe be funded by the government. Is that what we've discovered?
And then you talk about, should it have other revenues within it? Should it have...
And rebuild every 5 years.
A hotel or a casino or whatever. We touched on it earlier. That's why the Wasps model was not... And it wasn't the Wasps model before, and it was the Coventry City model. Mm. But that model, if it's in the right location, isn't necessarily a bad idea.
No, I agree. I do agree. The only downside and this is, I think, what happened in Worcester, the downside to having a rugby club with loads of tangentially profitable businesses or valuable assets attached to a loss-making business is that the temptation is for bad actors to come in and get rid of the loss-making business and sell everything else off.
Yeah, but we come back to oversight, don't we, JB? Yeah, and at the end of the day, we all know that sport has, well, we should all know, that sport over the years, and it's happened in football a lot over the years, you get asset strippers coming in, looking at football clubs and saying, the value's in the property, the value's in the land.
I completely see that as well.
And then running the whole thing down over a period of time and effectively being, as you say, being a bad actor.
Yeah.
That, again, is one of the reasons why in certain other countries, the sharing model or the multi-use model or the multifunctional model is there to give some degree of protection because... Yeah. You know, we can all think of examples of sports clubs that have lost their stadia. They tend to be in inner urban areas traditionally, and then moved out somewhere on the fringe next. Sometimes for the very good reasons, and sometimes it really works. Okay, other times it's an asset strip, and the whole thing collapses. Look, it's you can't run a sports business based on spectators without the right size stadium, with the right income streams. But the way you manage your capital spend and the way you finance it and whether you do it through a debenture, we haven't even touched on this, whether you do it through a debenture scheme, whether you do it through loans, whether you do it through equity, whether you do it through a land sale, whether you do it through a rental agreement. I mean, the ones that are really interesting, like one of the stands at Leeds at Headingley, was financed entirely by the university taking the whole of the stand except the seats.
Really?
Which they needed. And the club said, well, we don't need any more hospitality. We just need more seats. So Gary Hetherington did a great deal with Leeds Carnegie, not a dissimilar to deal the one Saracens have just done with Middlesex University. In their second stand at Stonex.
That's very interesting.
So you have to think about it. It's probably the most important strategic decisions you make. I mean, when we were doing three phase development at the Stoop between 2000 and 2010. Yeah, and that was a combination of a land sale. We sold a pitch out the back for $3 million at some debt, and we borrowed some of it, so we had to get the books into some kind of shape to be and then not building too quick so that the fan base grew, and once the average got to a certain percentage, we'd build again. We did it in that sort of way because it was easier to finance. And one of my favourite phrases, you know, once the thing about stadiums is it's like selling fruit.
Go on.
Once the game's played, the fruit's all rotten and you can't sell it. The seats are gone. You can't sell them again.
Yeah, yeah, so true, isn't it?
It is like having a market stall with a certain number of apples. If you don't sell them by the end of the day, those apples are worthless, no matter how many you got.
Yeah, yeah, I can totally see that. And I can see what you're saying as well in relation to someone like Exeter Chiefs who've sort of gradually built their stadium. Maybe they've built it a little bit too fast.
Yeah, Exeter is very similar to Quinn's. The Exeter model is really quite similar to Quinn's. Take a state, although theirs was a move from an inner city site, whereas Quinn's stayed where they always, well, where they had been for many, many years, not where they'd always been, but where they'd been for many years and developed it piece by piece.
God, we...
Whereas Exeter sold the county ground in the middle of Exeter and built Sandy Park and bought the land and started the development with the money they got from the old one. They were one of those ones where they didn't lose control of the asset. They used the asset to finance a new asset, but what you were talking about,
yeah,
and then grew that gradually as their fan base grew.
Yeah. Tell you what, $3 million now seems a bit cheap for a rugby pitch in Twickenham.
What they pay for Quinn's?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean that was interesting. I remember talking to one of the owners of Quinn's after I'd known him for many years. I felt brave enough to ask him. You know, was buying the Stoop his insurance policy for Quinn's going bust? You know, 11 acres of land in southwest London didn't seem the worst. He said,
no.
Certainly not. Certainly not. He said, we'd never let Quinn's go bust. No, not at all. He said it was an insurance policy there. I said, oh yeah, what for then? If it wasn't for, he said, for the league going bust.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I can see that. I can completely see that. Crikey. Do you know,
that was a long time ago. I should say that conversation was well over 15 years ago.
And more pertinent, more pertinent than ever.
Well, possibly so. But I did think that was, yeah, these people are so much cleverer than me.
Yeah. Well, do you know, we've done over an hour, and I don't want to turn
this into an
egg chasers marathon. But to tell you what, there's so many more things we could talk about here. I'd love to get into the weeds on debentures and funding and everything else, which we will do in the future. But yeah,
that'd be great.
Thank you very much, Mark. And
just a
shout out to our listeners before you go. If you want to contact me and Mark, contact eggchasers@gmail.com, give us your feedback on these episodes, and also let us know what you'd like us to talk about, because I mean, we can basically talk about anything which involves business and rugby and a bit of politics by sounds things. Anyway, Mark, I'll catch up with you soon.
And before we go, my little thing is, are we agreed it's now called Eggonomics?
I'm reluctantly going to have to agree with you. It is Eggonomics.
I told you it's a good name.
It's okay. I'm sure it'll grow on me.
JB, if you're not going to go with it, you've got to come up with something better.
No, I'm going to go with it.
And you're not only going to win me over, you've got to win our listener over. So you know, I reckon you've got another 10 days, and it's a lost cause.
I totally agree. I think I am fighting a losing fight here.
All right, mate. You take care, and see you next month.
All right. See you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.